Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political, and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this opening keynote, Power Play, Who Really Rules Today? I'm Claire Fox, and I'm the director of the Academy of Ideas. And I was really positive about having this discussion, particularly having read Matt Goodwin's book, Values, Voice and Virtue, more of which later, which one of our speakers, indeed, Matt. And in that, he argues that, quote, the people who really ruin Britain, really run, even.
And ruined.
Do you know what I mean? Run, ruin. Anyway. Are a new dominant class that imposes its radically progressive cultural values on the rest of the nation. Matt wrote that and everybody else shouted, rubbish. Or certainly the commentariat did, often the very people that Matthew was critiquing. I thought that was worth looking into. But this session is inspired by Matt's book, but it's not about it. And people will address the question as they see fit. Because there really is a public sense of frustration that in broken Britain, regardless of what voters demand or vote for, there's a whole series of barriers to action. Those in power seem to be powerless, or at the very least, say they can't do what the voters say because, oh, I don't know, of the blob or the judiciary or anyone else. And it feels as though it's the very opposite of that notion of taking back control. It feels that the public have no control, and it seems that those in power say they have no control. So what's going on? That's what we want to dig deep into. And you can read the full blurb on the website to see that I've asked our panel to do something utterly impossible, which is to set out their views in 6 minutes each. When I just said that to Matt Goodwin, he looked absolutely horrified, by the way. I did send an email round, but obviously nobody reads them. Anyway, 6 minutes, and I'll be strict. Then we go straight out to the audience, and I'm going to take clumps of questions and points, then back to the panel, then out again to the audience, then back to the panel. In other words, this is a public conversation in which we try and dig deeper. So let's meet our speakers in the order they'll speak. We're going to start, indeed, with the person who inspired the session, which is Matt Goodwin, who's Professor of Politics at the University of Kent. He made his name, in fact, or certainly made an impact on my thinking with his previous book, National Populism and the Revolt Against Democracy. And now his latest book, the full title of which is Values, Voice and Virtue, The New British Politics, is a book that has certainly set a debate going and people discussing it and so on. Matt is a prolific commentator, hard to turn the telly on or listen to the radio without him being on, and that's important because he's a public intellectual. And one thing I would commend to you is his Substack, which is mattgoodwin.org, whatever, but just go Substack Matt Goodwin, because it's actually a must read and I find it very helpful. Then we're going to hear from Pamela Dow. Pamela is Chief Operating Officer at Civic Future, a new organisation to open up politics and public life to a broader range of talent, and that seems to me to be invaluable work. Pamela has been a senior civil servant, has supported major public service reforms, especially in education and criminal justice, and she did a stint in the private sector at Tech City UK, Tech Nation. But more importantly for me, she also helped us set up debating matters in Israel, in the news, and debating matters, when we did it as debating matters beyond bars, in prisons, for prisoners to be able to debate. So she's a great friend of the work that we've done over the years. I'm delighted she's here. We're then going to hear from Anand Menon, who is the director of the Economic and Social Research Council Initiative, UK in a Changing Europe. UK in a Changing Europe bring out reports, organise events. A lot of people say that they're sympathetic to a Remain point of view, and certainly the majority of the audience tend to be like that. But the one thing that I've stressed over and over is that as a Brexiteer, when I go to those events, I'm always made feel welcome. They're actually interested and open-minded enough to have the debates out, and their reports are actually brilliantly well-researched and worth reading. So I'm delighted he's with us. He's Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London. He's almost as prolific a commentator as Matt Goodwin. And there's a lot more. There's a lot more to all of my speakers, and you check their bios out on the website. Harry Lambert will go next. Harry's there. He's a staff writer at New Statesman. He's the editor of New Statesman's Saturday Read newsletter, which I highly recommend and enjoy receiving. He's written cover features for the New Statesman on universities, Number 10, the BBC, Labour, artificial intelligence, and tax. He makes me feel rather old because I first met him when I was speaking when he was a student. It was actually a very good debate at York University, and now he's all grown up and he's become, I think, one of the ones to watch in terms of future political commentators. So I'm delighted Harry's with us. And then finally we'll have Professor Frank Faraday, sociologist, social commentator, a professor for many years at the University of Kent and now executive director of the think tank MCC in Brussels. He's prolific as an author, another prolific one. So many books. I just want to mention a few for this session. 100 Years of Identity Crisis, Culture War Over Socialization, How Fear Works, Culture of Fear in the 21st Century, and Authority, a Sociological History. In other words, we've got a panel that is so well qualified to think about this, it's not true. And I apologize that I'm giving them 6 minutes each, but that's all they've got. Then we're going to have the conversation with the audience. Let me start with you, Matt, and can we give them all a warm welcome before he starts?
Thank you very much, Claire. Battle of Ideas is always a highlight of my year. I'm going to make 4 points in 6 minutes. Why are we all here? We're here because there is a crisis among the elite, a crisis among the ruling class. And that crisis is still having profound effects on our politics and our society. Primarily, my first point is that this is a crisis of moral legitimacy and authority. What is the difference between the old elite and the new elite? The old elite, as Frank Faraday pointed out in an excellent Substack post this morning, wasn't really ideological. The old elite had it easy in the sense that this was a time of the Cold War, this was a time of the threat from communism, this was also a time of a strong nation state that was accountable and responsive, which here in Britain was organized around the strong unitary state, the Westminster model. Politicians could, at least until the 1970s, essentially deliver. And during that era, the elite was responsive and in very broad terms, respected the institutions of the state, didn't need to question the institutions of the state. In the 1970s and from then increasingly, we've seen authority drain away from the elite, globalization, European integration, the rise of technocracy, deregulation, here in Britain, devolution. And many of the elites participated in that process even though it simultaneously undermined their authority and legitimacy. They invested in it because, as Chris Bickerton has argued, they increasingly derived their authority not from the vertical relationship with voters, but from the horizontal relationship with other elites. And so we entered into what Colin Crouch has called the era of post-democracy. Increasingly, elites ruled over what Peter Mayer had called the void, leaving voters feeling as though they were no longer even in the conversation. And it's no coincidence that that was also the time academics began to talk about the era of de-alignment, the era in which voters were no longer being tribally loyal to the main parties. So point one is we've been living through a crisis of moral legitimacy and authority. The second point is the elite have been failing to deliver, which has been exacerbating this crisis, largely because They sent power and authority away from the centre to other institutions. Frank had a great line in his blog this morning, which I'm shamelessly plagiarising. He said, "Power is nothing when it has lost meaning. Power is nothing when it has lost meaning." And that is exactly what we're living through, because the chief story of the last 40 years in this country and many other Western democracies is a story of elite failure. It is a story of elite failure. The great financial crash, stagnant economies, inequality, spiraling national debt, the failure to see inflation coming, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, the Middle East, and yet we're told again and again and again to return moral legitimacy and authenticity to that same elite. Yet the last 30, 40 years have been a consistent story of elite failure. It doesn't matter if Labour and Keir Starmer win the next election, the story will be the same. National governments that are constrained increasingly by forces that are beyond their control because they've given up so much power and authenticity and legitimacy to other actors. Point three, both of these things, the draining away of power and influence, the draining away of moral legitimacy, has led the new elite to search for a new means of moral legitimacy. Some, like Labour and Keir Starmer, are desperate to return to the European Union because it's the only form of legitimacy and authenticity they understand. They want to give power away because they don't really know anymore what to do with power themselves. But it's also led the elite to do something else. It's led them to increasingly embrace social and cultural power as a means of their moral legitimacy. They've embraced values increasingly to try and project their authenticity and authority to others. And so the new elite has been searching around now desperately for an ideology that validates the ruling class. But as we can now see through its embrace of social and cultural liberalism and increasingly radical progressivism, that really only represents 20% of the country, as the British Social Attitude Survey has shown. Only 20% of Britain shares the values of this new ruling class. And this new ruling class is profoundly insecure, but it's also profoundly narcissistic, and it's also politically intolerant of people who hold different political beliefs. And it's turned to cultural power to try and give itself a sense of solidarity, but at the same time, those values are undermining its authority among ordinary voters. So culture has become the predominant means through which elites understand themselves. Let me repeat that. So culture has become the predominant means through which the new elite understands itself. And that is why it has increasingly lost support and the loyalty of the masses, because the cultural values that the new elite are pushing are hardwired to push us apart and not pull us together. It's not only about values and ideology, it's also about status, because the new elite increasingly use their values as a source of status. Their luxury beliefs, mass immigration, weaker national borders, the breakdown of family, the erosion of cultural guardrails that used to hold people together, the new elite now derive their sense of status by projecting their luxury beliefs in order to distinguish themselves from everybody else in society. The low-status masses, the gamins, the racists, the ignorant bigots, because it's the only way now they have of upholding and trying to restore their sense of moral legitimacy. But the lesson of the last 10 years in politics is that voters won't stand for it anymore, and that's my fourth and final point before Claire kicks me off. The populist rebellions of the last 20 years do not represent the end of the revolt. They represent the beginning. The era of de-alignment is going to be with us, and it will accelerate over the next few years and decades as voters increasingly look at a self-serving, insular, narcissistic, politically intolerant elite that no longer represents the values of the wider majority, no longer gives them a voice, and no longer treats them as legitimate and acceptable members of the wider community. So until we restore power to the people, until we restore power, popular sovereignty, the rebellions of the last 20 years are only going to get bigger and bigger. Thank you very much.
thanks, Matt, who stuck to 6 minutes. Congratulations, that was brilliant. Anyway, Pamela Dow. Pamela.
Thanks, Claire, and thanks, Matt. I agree with... Thank you. I agree with pretty much everything Matt says, but I want to put forward two additional perspectives for us to think about today. So the first is that we might be a bit more forgiving of the elites if they were actually elite, Matt's second point. And secondly, that a big problem with a lot of the people Matt describes is that they're in office, but they're not in power. So I think we're all okay about elites when they are actually elite, aren't we? We love elite footballers, surgeons, engineers, playwrights, musicians, people at the absolute top of their game who've combined talent and hard work to get there. I don't think any of us have got a chippy opposition to excellence. If we watched a civil service permanent secretary in front of a select committee and thought, well, there's definitely a type there, public school, Oxford, INSEAD, Whitehall, and their Overton window of acceptable opinion appears to run the gamut from Alistair Campbell to Rory Stewart, but at least they're competent. At least they've got mastery of a £2 billion budget. At least they're achieving stuff in effectively administering public services. At least they're showing unifying, courageous leadership in navigating the crazed narcissism and identity fads of the modern world. Place. But we're not thinking that, aren't we? We're thinking, good grief, this guy makes my year 8 netball teacher look like Lee Kuan Yew. Similarly, if we watched a reporter or read a journalist and thought, okay, it's a bit annoying that they all went to the same university and inhabit the same ideological milieu, but the concision, the accuracy, the absolute integrity of their report makes me grateful they're doing what they're doing, finding facts, bearing witness, seeking truth. But we're not thinking that, are we? We're thinking, why am I getting all this personal editorialising rather than objective insight? What's with the lazy metaphors and the weird obsession with the superficial over the serious? And in case you think I'm being unfairly critical of the unelected, exactly the same can be applied to politicians. If we were looking at the median politician and thinking, well, they do all seem to come from a tiny pool of life experience, but listening to them debate is like watching Roy Jenkins and Tony Benn debate membership of the EU, or Bill Buckley and Gore Vidal competing political philosophies. I'm in awe of the way they explain the complexity of border security and productivity. So I know exactly what the hard choices are and willingly delegate to them the authority to make them. Watching them use logos, pathos, ethos to make a compelling case and win hearts and minds is like watching a master of their craft. They've got my vote. But we're not thinking that, are we? We're thinking... Either this person's an idiot or they think I'm an idiot. Why can't they explain supply-side economic policy? I say all of this with the caveat, of course, that there's honourable exceptions. Many of you know who I've been lucky enough to work with in my career, many superb public servants at the top of their game. But they're the exception, and they're not the majority in those positions, elected or unelected, and they have to be, given the times we're living in. And by the way, that's why I joined Munira Mirza to set up Civic Future, to build a new, deeper, better-prepared talent pool for public life. My second point adds another layer. So these already not very elite people may be in office, but they're not in power. Modern bureaucracies, that is, large institutions in the public or private sector, are increasingly dominated by the unthinking and compliant, the process drone over the innovative problem solver. Leaders either can't or won't overrule HR, and HR is the growing function everywhere. Elected politicians are trapped like non-player characters. Hat tip to my good friend Dom Cummings there for another pithy image. These are people who can't swerve from following a corporate policy, even when it's blatantly masochistic or pointless. As Max Weber said, the individual cannot squirm out of the apparatus in which he's harnessed. We've created systems so massive, complicated, that no one's in charge, and we've given the junior drones operating within them way more influence than they even realise they've got. Let's take Matt's issue, identity politics. It should be a simple act of decisive leadership to put an end to wasteful, divisive, performative activity. The evidence that much of the so-called DEI training is junk is clear, and it's becoming costly. High-profile payouts where a combination of zealous activism and corporate complacency has been proven illegal. Ministers couldn't have made clearer that where there is zero correlation, let alone causality, between activity and outcome, it needs to stop in the civil service. Yet the last chief people officer still went ahead and wrote a blog about Naomi's pronouns and gender being assigned. He wasn't on a cultural Marxist campaign. I don't think he was even being knowingly cynical as a slightly scared middle-aged white man. He was doing the equivalent of a golden Labrador rolling over and getting his tummy tickled. I'm not sure he even engaged his brain at all, because writing a blog like that is just what you do. It's expected, by your colleagues, by membership bodies, by charities. In that example, both he and ministers were in office but not in power. To end on a more positive note, there are examples where elite opinion can be shifted with tangible impact. Education. Over many years, with great leadership at school and commentator level, we've exposed the lazy charlatan Ken Robinson view of learning and proved the value of a knowledge-rich curriculum, an aspirational ethos, an emphasis on discipline. It is possible to be in office and have power, but it's hard graft. You need time, clarity, unity of purpose, relentless capacity to explain and persuade. Most politicians, senior leaders in every institution don't have these things. They're just trying to keep afloat in the organisational water they're swimming in. So my answer to the question is, who really rules, is, alas, no one. And we've never needed inspiring leadership more.
That was perfect. Some excellent examples there that really were vivid. Thank you, Pamela. Okay, Anna, your thoughts.
Thanks, Claire. I'm going to try and do what Matt did and summarise my thoughts in under four bullet points. I have to say, son of immigrants, middle-class kid, went to Oxford, taught at Oxford. When I picked up Matt's book, I did so with a sense of trepidation that it would be largely targeted at me. And I have to say, A, it's a very, very good book, and B, I agreed with most of it. I'm going to start with what I agree with, because I think Matt's diagnosis of where we as a country went wrong in economic and political terms is magisterial and basically right. We were let down by our political elites. We did find, by the time of the referendum in 2016, that there was a massive amount of both political, look at the vote for UKIP in 2015 and the lack of representation, and economic dissatisfaction with where the country had gone. We did have massively high levels of inequality, unimaginable, unconscionable levels of inequality for a country as small as this. And our politicians did put far too much faith in expertise and talked about that expertise as if it was finding the right answers to our problems with no distributional consequences. And looking back, it's clear as day that there were distributional consequences and the same people always won and the same people always lost. So I have absolutely no problem at all with Matt's diagnosis of the failure of our politics to deliver fair economic outcomes or even a properly representative political system. So the diagnosis is fine. Where I start to part company a bit with Matt, and this is my second point, is this notion of all-powerful new elite, where I think this feels a little bit conspiratorial to me. Firstly, we've always had elites in the plural, and they overlap, and they're like a series of Venn diagrams, and sometimes they're the same people, sometimes they aren't, but the people who are the elites in the arts aren't the people who are the elites in the press, aren't the people who are the elites in politics, and aren't the same people who are the elites in universities. And here again, I don't disagree with Matt that identity politics has gone way, way too far in some of our institutions, but I find it hard to pick up the Daily Telegraph or the Sun or the Daily Mail or the Daily Express and think of them as progressive woke warriors. So I think what we have to talk about is several different overlapping elites rather than one single one that controls our life, controls our politics, and controls our economy, because actually the story of the last 30 or 40 years is a story of battles between elites as much as it is of the elites versus the rest. The second problem I have with the elite stuff that Matt comes out with is, I think this would have been an even better book if it had come out on the 22nd of June 2016. It would have been spot on and it would have been incredibly prescient. It would have identified precisely where we were. The problem is I find it far less compelling now because stuff has changed. The hyper-globalization that Matt talks about, and quite rightly talks about as being a problem, though I disagree slightly with why it was a problem, is being rolled back before our eyes. All the major economies in the world are turning inwards. Globalization is in retreat. We'll see how far it will go, but I suspect that's going to last. MPs, the MPs of 2016 are not the MPs of today. I'm not for a moment doubting that Pamela's got loads and loads of work to do to ensure that the best get into politics. I'm not for a moment suggesting that our House of Commons is properly representative. But its composition has changed since the days of David Cameron. And actually, Matt tells a lovely little story in his book about the MP for Ingleton going to a village fete and basically describing the wrong village. because she was so totally unaware of her constituency. I think that's far, far less likely to happen now. If anything, the problem with our politics now is that our MPs have become local mayors and pay far too little attention to things like legislation, scrutiny, debates in Westminster, because they're so preoccupied with making sure they get their Instagram photos of themselves in every part of their constituency out in front of the people who vote for them. So I think, in a sense, it's an analysis that worked better before the changes we've seen in our politics now. Finally, in all Matt's talk about influence and about institutions, there is one that is really lacking, and that is the key one, which is government. Government in this country is incredibly powerful. And Matt kind of admits as much by pointing to the profound changes that Margaret Thatcher and then Tony Blair brought about in this country. Government has the power to change things. And far too often for me, talk about an elite is just finding a scapegoat for government ineffectiveness. The short answer I would give to the question of are we ruled by elite is no, we're ruled by incompetence. That's the fundamental problem we as a country face. It's not the blob, it's not the culture wars. It is the fact that for far, far too long we have been governed by people who either were unaware or didn't care about the problems that the country faces, or being aware of the problems that the country faces, have been simply incapable of putting the policies in place to address them, despite, for much of the last few years, having a significant majority in Parliament to do so. I don't think you can accuse Suella Braverman of being excessively woke, but on her watch, immigration has hit record levels. The problem we face at the moment is that our political leaders are simply not up to it. They do soundbite politics, they do performative politics, they do Twitter politics. What they don't do is substantive politics. And here, I think, my final point is where I would differ slightly with Matt. His, for me, is a bit of a council of despair. We're ruled by an elite over which we have relatively little, if or no, control, and our politics is doomed because there is nothing we can do about it. I think there's lots we can do about it. I think what we need to do is make it clear to our political leaders, elect better political leaders, because the challenges facing our country are clear as day. What we need now are political leaders willing to step up to the plate with the power that government gives you and address them for us.
Thanks very much, Anand. Anand had his phone, and I thought he was kind of doing Instagram pictures of himself, but he actually had his timer on, which is very efficient. Thank you. That was really insightful, and I think raises some interesting challenges. Harry.
So, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I just want to go back to the question. The question is, who rules Britain? And I want to distinguish between two groups. There's the cultural left, and there's the economic right. We haven't actually heard a huge amount about it on the panel today, but in general, the thesis that I think you've really heard from Matt and others in recent years has been that the cultural left has essentially taken control of the country, that they're in the ascendancy. And the Brexit and the realignment are in many ways a reaction to them. For me, the only ascendant class in this country is the economic right. I think the failings of the economic right, and I'll explain what I mean by that, are what drove the reaction that you saw in Brexit and continue to drive the failings in our politics, continue to leave half the country behind. And there's been this excessive focus on the cultural left. However, having said that, I want to first of all start by saying I was in Sussex University in the week that Kathleen Stock was, if you like, getting cancelled or certainly hounded from campus. I was in her living room interviewing her at the time. And I saw the way that 100 students could essentially take over the campus and create an environment in which it felt impossible for her to do her job. I don't think there's any doubt, and you can ask any number of professors both in the UK and in the US, from Nicholas Christakis in the US to Jonathan Haidt to David DeCosimo to Arif Ahmed in the UK to Kathleen herself, that there has been a real, if not a takeover, then a pressure created by a group of students in this country and in the US in recent years. And you're also seeing the same sort of thing in public institutions. Civil servants who are being sent or sending round documents that don't seem to align with certainly what the public have voted on or even what law states. You know, equality law seems to be in some ways being challenged by sort of internal documentation which feels undemocratic. So in that sense, I sympathize with those who think the cultural left rules Britain today. However, I think we make a real mistake when we treat these essentially elite institutions, universities, certain media companies, publishing companies, parts of the civil service, as Britain. They are not Britain. And the reality is, the thing that really determines what happens in this country remains what it has always been, which is money and material reality and moneyed interests. And I think we err when we stop thinking about that. And let me explain what I mean. I think that if you look at our political class, you look at Sunak, you look at Starmer, they've actually both been quite willing in recent years to push back against some of those ideological excesses we've seen. Starmer's certainly shifted his position on identity politics in recent years. Sunak has become a vociferous critic despite his supposed liberalism. But what have you not seen? Sunak has done nothing to change the tax system from which he personally benefits. Starmer and Reeves are at great pains to say that nothing will change under a Labour government. There won't be any change in any of the taxes that really determine where power is distributed in this country. We have a tax system that is designed to protect wealth and protect those with assets at the expense of everyone else. The Labour Party don't want to do anything about that. So when I think about who rules Britain, I mean, Matthew said at one point in his speech, he said, the last 50 years have been the story of elite failure. I don't think they have, actually. I think they've been the story of elite success. But what has the success delivered? It's delivered great returns for those who have capital. And that's been the story since the 70s, ever since Dennis Healey failed to introduce the annual wealth tax that he won, the Labour Party won an election on in the 1970s. Since then, you had Thatcher come in, inequality spiked massively as the tax system changed. And as globalization was unleashed, you had Blair do nothing to redress that inequality. I mean, he did a little bit at the bottom end, and I don't want to be unfair to people in the New Labour project who were really focused on the bottom end of the society, but they did nothing to address the distribution of resources at the top end. And we're now at a point where, since 1997, wealth as a proportion of GDP has doubled, and the returns on that wealth have all gone to a tiny minority. Wealth inequality in this country is completely entrenched. It has not fallen in the 17 years the ONS have recorded it. Every year, you can expect £4 in every 10 of new wealth in this country to go to the top 10%. £1 in every 10 will go to the bottom 50%. And yet we're up here talking about aspects of government, aspects of culture, and not talking about economics. We have to talk about economics. Economics is the first problem. And in fact, I would say that the excesses of the cultural left are really a product of economic security. You know, who are the people making the arguments in these universities? They're people who are coming from a position of, from a well-heeled background, frankly. You know, leisure is the mother of philosophy. The people who are agitating in these institutions are people who aren't having to ask themselves the tougher questions, like, how am I going to pay my rent? So I think if you don't focus on money and you just focus on the obsessions of a small class, you miss the story. And I think the realignment that's needed in this country is economic, not cultural. And the sources of discontent that led to Brexit were economic, not cultural. We can talk about immigration, and we will, I'm sure, throughout this debate, but the reality is our political class don't want mass immigration. They've tried to be responsive. You know, the biggest problem we have is the small boats crisis. That's an unwilled crisis. So I think, again, this picture we've been slightly missold is of cultural excesses, rampant immigration, but no one's dealing with the fundamental problem, which is the ascendancy of the economic right.
Thanks, Harry. I think that was a very well articulated challenge in relation to this, and I think that it's something we should take very seriously. Just one thing is, on Kathleen Stock, one of the things I'm proud about this festival is Kathleen Stock is speaking here, and she's not talking about sex or gender. She's talking about artificial intelligence. In other words, she's a philosopher who should be taken seriously as a philosopher rather than simply always carted out as one other thing. So I'm really pleased about that. But anyway, can we hear our final speaker, which is Frank Brady?
So the bad news is that, unlike the other speakers who only had 4 points, I got 24 points to make. The good news is that I'm only going to make 1 point all the way through, because if you read my Substack this morning, that I wrote this morning, it's all there. But what I really want to talk to you about is the way that the new elite, I call them to myself and to my close friends, the pronoun elite, who are essentially a group of individuals who dine out on California values, who they are and how they operate. That's really what I'm really interested in. And in particular, what I'm really interested in is the way that culture has become the main medium through which the elite understands itself, but also the medium through which economics and politics is exercised. So culture is the only game in town. And if you don't believe me, I suggest you read the Harvard Business Review or any business publication which the economic classes dine out on. And you will find that when you read the Harvard Business Review, it reads like as if it was written by a sociology lecturer in a new polytechnic or a new university that used to be a polytechnic. You'll find that all the language and all the ideals that are second or third rate in a higher education system are regurgitated in this managerial speak, and then it becomes the language that they themselves use, not only to show off that they're at the Harvard Business Review, but as a way of making sense of who they really are, because what distinguishes this group of people is that they lack something that any real elite desperately needs, is a sense of cohesion, what they used to call a l'esprit de corps, a kind of solidarity, or you can even call it noblesse oblige. And one of the reasons why they are as incompetent as you were saying, I mean, they are really, truly incompetent, and they really are unable to deliver on any of their promises, is because they are a collection of individuals. There's very little that kind of binds them together, and it's a paradox, because if you go to a dinner party with these people, you will know in advance how they're going to react. I mean, on any question from Israel to pronouns to, you know, sort of transgender politics, you know exactly what they're going to say before they open their mouth. And you kind of wonder, you know, how can they do that when they themselves are so fragmented, when they themselves have very little that kind of binds them together. And I think what allows them to do this, why they intuitively and instinctively react in the same old, bad, anti-populist way, is the fact that they've culturally absorbed certain kinds of values that usually begin in California and are almost overnight absorbed and internalized by these individuals. So it seems to me that one of the important points to understand is that the real problem that British society has as far as political rule is concerned, or the lack of rule, is the fact that most of the time, all the issues that we're confronted with emanate from their own confusion. As they're trying to sort their own way out, they're trying to find some mode of legitimacy. It's almost always issues that they themselves are playing around with in order to give themselves a certain sort of medium of legitimacy through which they can draw themselves together. And that's why one of the curious things about politics in this country is almost everything that government does, and this has been the case for a very long time, almost everything that government does is not a response to the demands of the people. It's not like what governments used to do. They say, oh yeah, the people need this and the people need that, and therefore we're going to make sure that this happens. Very often what they call reforms are reforms that they've invented, that they think is important for themselves, which they themselves push down our throat. They are not interested in becoming politically accountable for a very simple reason, that they haven't got a political ideology through which the world can be understood, which is why one of the characteristic features of all these different groups is continually to disperse political ideals and continue to depoliticize public life. What they're always doing is they're outsourcing decisions. When you're looking at all the different institutions that are making our decisions, from NGOs to international organizations, to expert bodies, to the courts, it's almost as if all that parliament has become is a talking shop, because all the really important matters are decided elsewhere, and that is a conscious policy on their behalf. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, first of all, what it means for us is that everything that they do is based upon their attempt to gain cultural hegemony. because it's only through culture that they can have any sense of themselves. And the way they make that next set of cultural hegemony is by reducing us from the status of citizen to something else. So we're either stakeholders. Matthew and I are stakeholders. You know, I always think of holding an iced tea bone in my hand, and that's who I am. Or we're clients, or we become customers, or we become patients. I mean, that's really how they perceive us. And everything they do is designed to reduce us to this passive individual without a voice. And to me, the real struggle that's taking place in the culture war is, how do we get our voice back? How do we make sure that people are able to express their real feeling without censoring themselves? How do we create enough spaces where people can say what they really know to be true, but very often simply cannot be said? And one of the crucial battlegrounds is to create that situation where, on the one hand, we are forced to keep quiet, we are reduced to the role of being stakeholders and patients, and instead what we want to do is to emerge and assume the role of citizens who are able to be properly accountable, force our people at least to be accountable to us, because it is us that needs to decide the future of our society. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all of the speakers. And they will want to talk to each other and hold each other to account. But they're going to do that by me taking a group of questions, and then I'll come back to them and they can reflect on something that somebody else has said as well. I think that point that Frank made about voice is very important. And I actually think it's the forgotten word in the title of Matt's book. Because I think that whole idea of voice, giving people a voice, the idea of feeling you haven't got a voice, is certainly one of the things that's animating politics. So now you've got a voice here. There's people with microphones, so wait till the microphone arrives. And can I see who wants to speak, please? Right, now, because I saw him first, there's a gentleman right at the end, standing up by the wall. Yeah, him, yeah.
Hi. I don't like to talk about incompetence. I think the bigger issue is indifference, because I think if you look at our elites, they are, generally speaking, competent, but they're indifferent about immigration. They're indifferent about who owns the railways and the public utilities. They're indifferent to what happens on day-to-day lives of the people. And I think by saying that they're incompetent, it's excusing their indifference and lack of care for the common people.
Okay, thank you. Interesting point. Okay, so I've got a little clump of people over here, and then I'll start out on this side, yeah? So let me just say, green arm. Yeah, sorry.
Hello. yes, thanks very much, everybody. I very much liked Ann-Nan said that we need to be careful about talking about the elite, and I think we do need to try and define things properly. However, I disliked very much when he said that globalization has been rolled back. So I think there's no evidence of that whatsoever. And I think part of what you're talking about is where our politicians and others who have potentially got ability to govern are falling over themselves to outsource the decisions and outsource and hide behind where those decisions are taken so that they can't be held accountable. But I think we also, as I think Frank said at the end, there's a guilt that we have, the mass of the people that live in this country, that for many, many years we contracted out responsibility for governing to politicians. We elected them every 5 years and we let them get on with it. And then we were shocked when they stopped getting on with it. And therefore, for the 40 years in which we were in the EU, they lost the ability to scrutinise, to write legislation, etc., etc. And we now need to wake up to our lack of taking that responsibility, and I think we need to take responsibility back so that we rule.
Okay, thank you very much. Actually, that outsourcing thing is interesting, by the way, because whenever I try in the Lords to raise things and say, you know, why did somebody do that, they say, oh, that wasn't us, that was Ofcom
or that was a judiciary review, or we had to do that because it said so in this other piece of legislation. So you sort of think, well, what were you doing? You know, you can never pin them down. So there is something really in that. Yeah, that gentleman there. Yeah, thank you.
I think Harry's point is particularly important in terms of thinking about the lack of rollback of globalisation, which I also disagree with. I think it's very telling that Liz Truss can essentially be overturned by forecasts from the IMF. It's very telling that all of our pensions have to be invested in ESG funds, which are deliberately promoting inefficient investment from companies that deliberately do things that we don't agree with. It is almost impossible for anyone on a PAYE salary to make it into the upper classes at this point, and that was not something that happened before. And I think a lot of these influences are coming from a global financial market that we genuinely have no control over and almost no ability to impact. And I think I would like to hear more about the sort of supranational challenges that we face to try and do anything. We talk locally about the blob and councils and courts, but this is a global issue, and there isn't really anywhere to hide on a lot of those topics.
Okay, thank you. That person there. Then I'll take a couple of them over here, come back to the panel. Then I'll do the back on both sides. Yeah, yeah.
Matt Goodwin, you said that the elite now they get a sense of legitimacy from values and culture. And this is a change that's come out recently. I'm just wondering, where did the legitimacy come from before, and how do we get back to that position?
Okay, thank you very much. Right, over here. So there's the... Right, so there's you in the... I thought you in the front, check shirt, and then you...
Hi. There's a lot of talk about individuals in the elite and their behaviour and their competence. I'd like to hear more about... their incentives, because I think people do respond to the incentives that they're under, and also structures. So I've not heard the word technology, for example. I really believe that like our intellectual environment, our media environment has changed because of technology. So for example, paid news has been undermined by the free media model, which drives clickbait, which drives people to talk in the kind of simplistic way that the panelist from Civic Futures, whose name I've forgotten, was Pamela. Talking about. I've met politicians who are like, oh, we'd love to do that, but how can we sell it when we're in this clickbait environment? So what do we do about these drivers, which I think technology is a big one, and also, like, we're not talking about who they are, we're talking about their competence, but, like, what's the field of selection? So obviously Pamela's working on that, Civic Future are working on that, but, like, how well are our MPs paid? They used to just do it for free because they were rich, but now they're not. So now they can be bought off because they're allowed second jobs. So why don't we pay them properly and ban them from having second jobs? Things like that. Structures and incentives. I just want to hear more about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The person behind... No, can you send it behind, if you want me, to that gentleman there? And then I'm back to the panel for just... You only just pick up one or two points. You can't speak for another 6 minutes. Right.
I certainly agree about the point about incompetence, and it's a big issue as to how we get people in power controlling things who do have the competence. A very big and important question. I also agree about money, and that the way that people with money are actually have the power to actually attract more money to themselves rather than to the general population. But the one thing I didn't hear, and I think who rules Britain today, I think it's the Daily Mail. And we've not talked at all about the impact of press and the mass media. And it's not like in Russia, okay, it's not quite so controlled as that, but it still has an enormous impact on the way people think.
Thank you very much. Okay, so actually, I know it sounds, but I'm actually going to start with you, Harry. I'm going to kind of just whiz along the panel, yeah?
Well, I'll just start with that one. And also go back to the first question about national ownership of utilities and railways. I think you're absolutely right. The press...
Speak louder.
You're absolutely right that the press are a massive part of how political debate works in this country. Take national ownership. Overwhelmingly popular position would be to nationalise certain public utilities and even the railways. It'd also be very popular to introduce some of the tax rises that I want to see, such as reforms to council tax, an equalisation of capital gains tax rates with those on income tax, even an annual wealth tax on those with estates over 1 million or 10 million. These are very popular policies. and yet they don't happen. Why don't they happen? I think in large part it's the weakness of our political class and their fear, and that fear is partly a product of the press environment that they think everything's going to be filtered through. And I think it leaves us in this sort of stasis where we have popular policies, and in that sense I agree with Matt, you know, the will of the people isn't being carried out. We just disagree about what the will of the people is or where its focus should be, and so we've got to stick on the economics.
Okay, thanks. Alan.
Let me just quickly address two questions. There were questions about indifference and about incentives, and I think maybe in retrospect I was very naive, but I thought that actually Brexit and COVID gave us a massive opportunity because they underlined very, very clearly what some of the problems with our society are. Brexit, by its voting patterns, underlined patterns of regional inequality, political disaffection. COVID told us about key workers who are chronically underpaid, about health inequalities and things like that. And my hope was that the referendum made it in the interests of politics to realise we need to address these things or we'll get another revolt. So I think there's slightly less indifference now than there was pre-Brexit. At least we now talk about inequality, we now talk about levelling up, we talk about things that never made it onto the political agenda before 2016. The problem, of course, is to date, no government has been capable of actually acting on the words, and I get progressively less hopeful that they will. So maybe we'll sink back into indifference again.
Claire, am I disrupting the system to jump in?
Well, just let him finish it. Yeah, go on, quick.
Just quickly, I mean, on levelling up, if you don't reform council tax, then never talk to me about levelling up. You know,
yeah.
Council tax is something which is levied at 10 times a greater rate in poorer areas than richer ones.
Right.
I agree with Harry. But the second thing, just quickly on globalisation, I wasn't for a moment saying globalisation has ended. In fact, there's a really good piece by Andrew Neil in the Daily Mail today about bond markets, which illustrates the degree to which governments everywhere find themselves in hock to markets that are, by definition, not national and which control a lot of what governments do. But there has been a degree of rolling back of globalization in the trade sphere with reshoring and things like that. But you're absolutely right. One of the chronic problems with our politics is the degree to which politicians delegate control over certain decisions. And one of the big tests of our ability and willingness to reform that, I think, will be if Keir Starmer gets in, whether he delivers on the promise that take back control means devolution. Because one part of making our politics more effective and more legitimate is to devolve power away from a Westminster that has become too distant from the people, I think.
OK. I hate devolution, and we've got a session on it at the Battle of Ideas. So I'd mention. That was me jumping in. The big headline there was, and Anand says, there's a really good article in the Daily Mail. I thought, oh, my
by
God.
Andrew Neil.
Yeah, by Andrew Neil. That's enough to tweet. Right, Pamela.
Very quickly, I'm going to take indifference and structures as well. So I think your point's really, really well made about indifference, but I think it's I don't think it's separate for incompetence. I think it's linked to my second point about just the sheer complexity and size of the system. So people become indifferent because they can't make anything work, and then they get, you know, they get less and less able to make it work. So I think you're right. I think the further people are removed from having any sort of control over railways, potholes, you know, whatever it might be, the more indifferent they become, and that is because of the complexity of the organisations and all the things that Claire said about, you know, well, who's actually accountable? Oh, well, Ofcom did this, you know, 20 years ago, and we can't change it. So I think they're part of the same problem, and it's not unlinked to the God, that's such an uncivil service way of saying it, isn't it? It is linked to the incentives point as well. So I think on this point about technology, there's two things. I completely agree with you that the politician's life is so much more difficult than it was, you know, even quite recently. But they don't all have to be on Twitter. There's a prisoner's dilemma problem there that a leader would have to say, right, you know, if Keir Starmer said to all, you know, all Labour MPs, none of you are going to be on Twitter. You know, it might be a bit scary, but there would be sort of safety in numbers, and it would free up hours and hours of time for them to read stuff properly. And I don't think anyone would mind. And I'm really baffled. So you know, the Substack phenomenon. People are clearly desperate to read long stuff. Look at the attendance today. You know, people are craving seriousness. So why have we got such you know, crap conversations on news programmes. Roy Jenkins and Tony Benn had an hour programme. You should watch it if you haven't watched it. I'm sure many people here have. There just aren't programmes like that anymore. But on the other side of technology, my perspective from a lot of the big bureaucracies I've worked in is technology's not good enough, because we've had to create all these sort of corporate droney roles because the technology's just failing. I mean, I've got, it's not completely linked, but I had some sympathy for Steve Barclay and Dom Raab, in fact. You know, if you're a minister, you shouldn't be getting a document with track changes in it. What's wrong with the system that the technology and the people operating the technology aren't good enough? So I do think there's something in technology, and I do think it's a problem to drone-like compliant behaviour, but I think it could be a force for efficiency and betterment as well.
OK, thank you, Pamela. Interesting points there, yeah.
Yeah, under the Daily Mail, I think you're wrong. I write for the Daily Mail sometimes, not all that much, but I know that the impact my article has on the Daily Mail is far less than my spiked online articles or what I write on my Substack. I think there's a 1970s idea of the media, which, I mean, that ship has gone. The role they play is very different, but the media is important, and its importance is in a totally different domain, which is that the cultural script that influences our elites is from the media. I mean, they're the most vociferous consumers of media. And in many respects, one of the roles of the media is actually to give our elites a semblance of coherence, a kind of a narrative and a script which they rely upon in order to make sense, which is why they are so sensitive to the media. If you look at, for example, the ease with which the media managed to get the Johnson government to overnight change its policy on COVID, and the way in which that kind of pressure, that kind of almost sort of surreal reaction they have towards the media, the obsession they have with the media, that is much more to do with a narrow section of our society than ordinary people on the street who actually are quite indifferent as to what the Daily Mail says or any other newspaper at this particular moment. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of globalization. You need to make a distinction between globalization as an economic phenomenon, which I think is gone. I think we now live in an era where regional blocs are emerging all over the place, and we have a greater focus on protectionism and a much greater fragmentation of the world economic order, and globalization as an ideology. Mm. Now, globalization as an ideology is still here, and that's because that kind of cosmopolitan impulse, which in a sense led to the development of globalization as an ideology, permeates elite thinking. That is still there and is deeply entrenched, and it allows them to make excuses. It allows them to explain away why they are so incompetent, why they couldn't do this, because the market says that. So in that sense, what we are confronted with is this phenomenon of an ideology, almost like a fetishistic ideology, that actually bears very little relationship to the emerging international order.
Okay, thank you. Matt.
Yeah, one of the reasons I now write on Substack rather than legacy media, well, there's two reasons. The first is it's a platform that is genuinely independent of legacy media and legacy institutions. And increasingly within our stifling, oppressive culture, I found it necessary, alongside many others, to write on a platform that allows me to say what I really think without fear of what might happen because of what I say. But the second reason is because the legacy media, the legacy institutions, are incapable of having this conversation. They are incapable of talking about the things that we are talking about today. And you see it partly reflected in the debate that we're having. There are so many people who lean to the left who are utterly incapable of talking about culture. They just don't see it as important. They don't see it as relevant. For them, it's only about this very narrow economic elite and Rupert Murdoch. It's like, welcome back to 1975. The world's changed enormously. Voters care just as much about culture as they do the economy, and it's not because they're being whipped up by press barons, it's because their culture is under attack. It's because their societies and their communities are being transformed before their eyes. These things are happening. Globalization is not just economic, it's cultural.
It's reflected in mass migration. It's reflected in the lack of integration in our communities. Who could look at the last 2 weeks in British politics and say culture doesn't matter? Like, seriously. Who could look at Britain over the last 2 weeks or all Western democracies and say, actually, the real story here is about an economic elite? No, that is one story. Nobody has ever said, I've never said, that there is only one elite. This is one of the big misconceptions of my book that has been pushed by people who clearly haven't read my book. What I've said is that there are multiple elites, but I've said the axis of power is tilting away from the old elite towards a new elite. That's the exact line I use in the book. And if you've read any of the statements from BlackRock, Larry Fink, major CEOs, et cetera, and you think that the economic elite is not now integrating itself into cultural debates, then I'm afraid you're not reading the research and you're not looking around. Because increasingly they use cultural power as a method of legitimating their interests. So you can't resort to this 1975 argument of is it economics or is it culture? Because they're now interlinking in such a profound way that our politics is changing along those lines. And to say that globalization doesn't matter or is in retreat in the same week that we remove caps on bankers' bonuses, in the same year that we push through the Edinburgh reforms for financial services in London, in the same year that politicians prioritize financial service regulation over genuine leveling up, I think is a nonsense.
Okay.
It's nonsense. Hyper-globalization, if anything, has accelerated. And the other point I would just say briefly,
just before I finish.
No,
keep it. Keep
it's
it.
It's just one line,
fair.
One line.
I've got a hand.
The argument.
Matt, let me take the audience. It's not that you weren't being interesting, but I just need to take the audience in. Right. There's a lady there, that's slightly orange. Yes, and then, yeah.
Quick question for Harry at the New Statesman. I'm pleased to hear that your interview went better with Kathleen Stock and you treated her with some decency, unlike your colleague a few years ago who stitched up and failed with the late Roger Scruton.
Is that a question?
My question to you is, you associate economic and financial clout, it seems to me, only with the right. What about very mediocre diversity officers who have no problem pulling in 80 grand a year? Or people running universities five or six times that much? Anything to say about that, Harry?
Thank you. I personally don't think Harry's responsible for everything that's wrong in the world. Or even everything that's happening at the New Statesman. But anyway, there you go. Yes, that person standing up is the person I'm taking. So whoever's got the microphone close.
Thank you. Incredible panel. Yeah. And I think some of the leadership and the debate that we need in Britain. But I would also say perhaps not being good enough as well sometimes. But Harry, I don't know what the left represents now. But is it capital appreciation? Is it productivity? Is it wealth creation for everyone? Or is it a myopic obsession just about taxation? To follow on from this point, equality, diversity and inclusion has so now dominated our institutions, not just a few theatres or universities, but banking, innovation. We're now being debanked because we don't have the right ideas. So-called capitalists who you are suggesting are obsessed just with money-making ventures are actually embarrassed about profits. No one wants to talk about, I say no one, the dynamic now is not to talk about wealth creation and dynamic growth. And it seems to me that I think the thing that everyone is saying is what's missing is who should rule. Because it's patently obvious that the public has not got our voices being heard. That's what's so great about this festival today. And that's why it's so important when the public do assert ourselves, when we do make our voices heard, like with recent things around net zero, another obsession by people who want to have sustainability, limits, restrictions, surveillance, not growth, not wealth creation for everyone at the bottom and the middle and everywhere else. That's why I'd invite everyone to get involved with Together. It's our campaign, we're here. And thank you to the Battle of Ideas.
Thank you. Right, somebody's just been... I'm losing control. Somebody's just been given a microphone, and yes, you can have a microphone. Oh, you've got it. Right, go on, you carry on.
Yeah, I'd like to hark to something that Matt said about the hollowing out of democracy today. I think this is happening. there is a void developing. Politicians are fearful today of saying anything that might transgress certain norms. And they also feel powerless because, as Matt said, power is being outsourced now to NGOs in particular, but also to academics and expert bodies. And the legislature feels more impotent than it did before. As an example of single-track thinking, I would like to talk about what happened in Ireland about a year ago. And that was in the Parliament, six parties voted in favour of a hate law, a hate speech law. All six parties, the leading, the top, the biggest parties, the six largest parties, all voted in favour of hate speech law. This is an example of single-track thinking, of conformity of mind, which is appalling, and it needs to be addressed.
Thank you very much. Very, very important law, that. Right, there's a gentleman standing on the... not standing, you. Stand up, and then they'll know who you are. Has somebody else got a microphone that I can't see, that I've missed? No. Right, you. And then I'm coming... Yeah.
Yeah, question predominantly for Pamela, but I'd welcome anyone's view. I don't know if anyone's read Rory Stewart's book, Like Him or Loathe Him, but he gives a staggering sort of anecdote there about when he was asked to sign off some aid funding in Syria, and essentially the civil servants wouldn't take no for an answer, and he got, you know, went round and round, and essentially they kind of overruled him and didn't give him the answers that he wanted. I suppose, how do we ensure that we have the accountability in the civil service, and that people have the right, you know, incentives, and that ministers ultimately have the power that they're elected to uphold.
Thank you. Right, there's, can we take a few people? I can't actually see anyone now. Yeah, so yeah, you, sir, because you, yeah, you.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yeah. I just want to draw on the wisdom of the movies, actually. And that famous, really intellectual movie, World War Z. And in World War Z, by the time the zombies get to Jerusalem, the Israelis were ahead of the game because they had this concept of the tenth man in their decision making. The tenth man's role was always to challenge. And because they had the concept of the tenth man challenging the groupthink, they prepared themselves against the zombies. So what about the concept of the 10th man?
Oh, very good. It's also the idea that the zombies are our threat. Right, okay. You, sir, stand up and then... Yes, you. Right, and then we know... Right, yeah. It's difficult with Nick, isn't it?
Thank you. I'm with some students from Sussex, and...
That's a bad way to introduce yourself in general, but...
Well, I was horrified by what happened to Kathleen Stock. I think Ray. It's outrageous. But it seems to me at Sussex University and many other universities across the country, if the political spectrum is that wide, you're only allowed to talk in this section. On many of my modules, there will be Marxist elements to pretty much every one of the modules I have done. And I'm not against learning that, but what I am against is not having something on the other side. The university students are being set up for a world which is not in reality, and as one of you said, only something like 20% of people in the country really identify with what this is getting pushed. You know, I'm someone who's on the centre-left. I don't think I've moved that far, but the far left have gone so far left that I no longer feel like there is a place for me. And I think that's really concerning. But my question is, how do universities get brought back to somewhere where there is a level of balance, where university students can go and learn about a wide range of ideas and not get perpetually offended by something happens and it doesn't suit their worldview? Because I think people are going to leave university and they're going to go, what I was taught at university is not the world in reality, and my opinions are not, and those of my friends, are really far removed from broad swathes of society. So how do, you know, not just culturally, but how do universities bring us back to an era where we can have genuine, decent debate with broad swathes of opinion? Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Dave from Liverpool. I was in the Momentum Hard Left in Liverpool, and I'm not really now. I was a soldier for about 16 years. I think that, like, the way that things have moved, I think it's it's down to like the economics. I think it was driven by greed and a lack of real patriotism. Put some notes here. The societal outsourcing of violence to the working class with the end of national service has made it violence as an abstract concept. And now it's like it shaped everything. It ends up being the privatisation of the weapons industry, which I think was an act of treason, and weakened the strength and efficiency of the nation state. They don't make weapons now to actually be efficient and work. They make them so they can get an upgrade contract and extract more capital. And this wave, it created a wave, an economic wave that now just gets served by political actors. I think the culture war, I agree with Matthew Goodwin's points. I agree with Alan Miller's points. I think they're very valid. I think there's a lot of valid points. What I'll say is that the wave, it's surfed into infrastructure contracts on the military bases. There was no unions for the military, so they couldn't push back on it. We started paying for our meals, Pays-You-Dine, Serco, Sodexo, Amy, these companies get the contracts for it. Then that builds credibility into them doing infrastructure contracts abroad. This then pushes the drive of the military-industrial complex. And then it's moved into like the asylum system and catching it on the back end, where now they're making fortunes off the back of these guys coming over on boats who are subverting the security. And they're subverting the security, and basically I think it's a national threat.
Thank you. But you've made some very good points, though. Thank you very much. Yeah, cheers. Right. Right. There's a person. Stand up. That person is really waving at me. Yes, you. Yeah.
Hi. I'm very excited about this. This is my first of these events. I was particularly struck by your point that citizens have been reduced to stakeholders and clients and a very passive voice. And I'm just wondering now, this is a brilliant idea, but how do we create spaces for debate throughout the UK throughout the year? Because there aren't the spaces. How do we become, as active citizens, capable of challenging these power structures and entering into our own power? So why aren't we using public libraries, for example? Well, I'll tell you one of the reasons. It's because public libraries are being stifled and there's a lot of censorship, and the Chartered Institute of Library Professionals are literally saying things like no debate. So where are our public spaces for every day? I'd like to offer this as a challenge to everyone, particularly you and the panel. Where are the public spaces and how can we reclaim them?
Okay, brilliant. Okay, because I'm going to take the panel so that I can come out and take a few more of you. Luckily, it's a long weekend, and you won't get all in now. But let me start at the other end. Matt, anything you want to pick up?
Yeah, I want to speak to the student who raised the issue about universities, because I was often told by people that I would describe as a new elite that we didn't have a problem in the universities, and they would line up on social media and say this. Now look at the last 2 weeks. Look at what's happened in the elite universities around the world. We've got a glaring problem. The answer we've already delivered in the UK. We've passed a Higher Education Free Speech Act, which is beginning to bring about real cultural change in universities. Again, something that many people, including the New Statesman, said we didn't need, when it was pretty obvious to anybody who works in the university that kids are not actually being given exposure to the full range of ideas that exist in society. And what I resent more than anything is the way in which we use this term culture war. When you're talking about free speech, free expression, the rights of women, sex-based rights for women, and the rights of our children not to be exposed to radical, dangerous, divisive, un-British ideas in school, like radical gender ideology and critical race theory, those are not culture wars. Right? That's the foundation of our society, that's the foundation of our civilization, and they use that term to curtail debate, to narrow down the conversation. These things are not acceptable to discuss. These things are not legitimate. You should only be talking about this issue. And in universities, unfortunately, it is incredibly visible how that strategy is used, and it's very depressing. So what we need to do, before you kick me off, Claire, the answer is very clear. I wrote it yesterday. Reform the institutions. Culture is downstream from the institutions. We need to reform the institutions. We need to ensure they have a diverse array of people from different backgrounds with different views. The BBC, the civil service, the universities, the schools, the creative industries, the media. The media is full to the brim of kids whose mummy and daddy worked in the media, who come from the same social background. So my kids at Kent can't get into the media because, guess what, mummy and daddy weren't in the media and they can't afford to do the internships at London. So we need to break open the national conversation.
Okay, thank you. Frank.
Can I come in?
No, you are coming in a minute. I'm going along the line. Right.
Yeah, just picking up on, or following up from Matt's point on universities, I've been teaching in universities for about 50 years, which is a very, very long time. And I've seen a great institution becoming one that's totally decadent and almost anti-civilizational in terms of its intellectual orientation. And I think that I'm really glad, especially this last 2 weeks, that most academics are really soft physically, because otherwise you'd have a powerful lynch mob that kind of would emerge within the university sector. But the thing that people don't realize is that the problem with the universities is not just that they mislead their students, but that they mislead the whole of society. Because people think that there is this isolation between society and university, and what goes on there doesn't really matter. But because the universities now are such a large institution, where more than half of young people go to universities, they have a disproportional impact on public life. So just to give you one example, you probably never heard of decolonization as an ideal. It's something that is all the rage in the university system. Well, since the war has broken out, all of a sudden everybody who can barely even spell the word decolonization is talking about it. And decolonization basically means that when you see young women being killed and raped and humiliated in southern Israel, and when you see babies being killed and civilians being shot down in front of your eyes, that can be excused because, as they put it, decolonization is not a metaphor. Which basically what that means to them is that decolonization legitimates the cleansing of the lives of people who you disagree with. Because what decolonization theory does is it empowers people to dehumanize their targets in a way that would have been unthinkable in previous times. And that comes out of the senior common room of universities, where there's ever so gentle, long-haired academics who are so careful with their pronouns and who actually tell you that words are violence and that silence is violence. When they say real violence in front of their eyes, all of a sudden, oh, it's in context. Oh, it's a metaphor. And go on to the next question.
Okay, thank you. I don't disagree with a lot of what Frank said, apart from the long-haired academic thing. I don't know what era that was from. Yeah, but anyway, right, Pamela, yeah, your era, yeah. Pamela.
I'm going to take the question that was directed to me. I haven't actually read Rory Stewart's new book. I read the one where he walked back from Iraq with his dog, and that was lovely, but I haven't read the new one. But that story sounds completely, believable. I'm afraid shit like that happens all the time. And I think there's what I said in my opening remarks about... about better leadership and, the alignment of the planets, where you've got absolute clarity of purpose of the politician. Longevity in post would be ideal, backing from number 10, where, if you're going to say something controversial, you know that you're going to get political support from it. If you applied a counterfactual onto that example of the aid to Syria, maybe he would have, he would have been successful, but it's hard. As I say, it was a hard graft. You asked about civil service accountability. I think that is the way the civil service gets, civil service doesn't exist apart from to serve ministers. It shouldn't, and there are real problems, and we've talked about them here, about it, as in all bureaucracies, that the policies of the bureaucracy are starting to, take over the leadership of the bureaucracy. But the civil service in particular can be directed by a strong, effective politician. I'm going to say his name because I haven't said it yet, but most of the departments that Michael Gove's gone into, he's managed to, every time he's got something back saying, you can't do that, oh, you can't do that, you're not allowed to do that, he's just gone back and gone back and gone back until he's been able to be successful. So it is possible. More transparency would also help. I think, I'm sure there's some people here have put in freedom of information requests, but usually the department doesn't want to release the information or the document, not because it's some kind of, conspiratory or sort of embarrassing remarks, usually because it's such low quality it would be embarrassing to have in the public domain. I just want to say really quick, specifically, I thought Harry made absolutely excellent points about economic right and cultural left. And I think any, you know, I know you might not be big fans of the IFS in this room, but Paul Johnson's book, Follow the Money, if you only read it from the point of view of sort of the sort of madness of fiscal and monetary policy over the last 30 years, it's worth it. The only thing I would say to Harry is, it's the opportunity cost of all these institutions spending time on cultural stuff that means that they can't devote their attention to the really serious stuff that you're talking about. It sounds like a really quotidian point, but it is actually diversionary. It takes brilliant people's minds away from what they should be thinking about.
Okay, thanks, Anand.
Just three things, I think. I mean, actually, on Paul Johnson, yeah, three very quick things. On Paul Johnson's book, I mean, I agree it's a very, very interesting book, but he's so naive about the politics in some places, I think, that it's a very economist approach. Now, I'd like to think that even when I had hair, it was never long, but when I had hair, I wouldn't have agreed with that. I mean, I agree absolutely with Frank on decolonization and the way it's being used in the context of what's happening in Israel. The notion that one side can never be wrong and one side can never be right is just barking mad. So I agree with him. I also agree with Matt about diversity, in the sense that we need our institutions to be diverse. We've done what has been, in many ways, the easy bit. We have representation of women, representation of minorities. They all tend to be middle class. We don't do enough to think about socioeconomic background in our institutions. We need to do more. There are some organizations, and this is going to shock you again, like The Spectator, that do internships blind on the back of a blog. So there is progress being made. Organizations are trying to address this. We should do lots, lots more. And I wouldn't for a moment deny either that we have a problem with our universities in terms of groupthink, in terms of significant problems with freedom of speech. All I can say, because I never even aspire to be a university manager, is that our organization aspires to get people of all views in front of audiences and to debate ideas, because whilst Claire and I disagree on an awful lot, we both share a commitment to free debate, free speech, and the ability to express your ideas and to debate them. One final point I would make is, I don't think it's care that no one cares about, it's true that no one cares about growth. I think it's a more subversive issue than that. No one has the first clue how to generate growth, which is a problem across Europe. And it's one of the reasons why our conversation about immigration is so profoundly dishonest. Our conversation about immigration is dishonest because politicians increasingly see it as the only way to bring about growth, while on the other hand telling us that they want to bring it down. And so growth, I think, and here I tend to lean towards Harry rather than towards Matt, that growth is the key. It is the economics of this that is going to drive a lot of the other debates.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Oh, thank you.
All right, just a few things. So, look, first of all, I'm not here to defend diversity offices. I'm not here to defend VCs on £400,000. I wrote a big piece called The Great University Con, which I'd recommend you go read, on the problems with our universities. Someone mentioned libraries, the stifling of debate. The biggest problem with libraries is that so many of them have been closed. We've barely discussed austerity all day. Yet, as you can guess, I think it's an important point in this debate. This fellow here was nodding at me when Matt was speaking, saying he's talking about you. But what I want to know is, what do Matt and I really disagree on? Because I have said, and I've gone and reported on, the excesses of the cultural left. And I agree with Pamela. That's why I mentioned them in my initial speech. So I'm not here to defend the madness that we've seen in certain institutions. What I'd like to know is, does Matt agree with me? Does he agree that we should shift the tax burden away from workers and onto wealth? Does he agree with me that we need public ownership of utilities? Does he agree with me that the next government should obsess over tax evasion and how to properly tax multinationals? I don't believe in hyperglobalization. That's what I'm here to argue against. So I'd like to know whether Matt is with me on economics, because I'm not against what the panel is saying on culture.
Thank you very much. I'm going to now take three people, and I'm going to take one of the people from the balcony, because it's the novelty, because we've got a balcony, and I believe there's a microphone, so can somebody with a microphone get somebody on the balcony to have the microphone? And I'm sorry to the other person on the other side. I did want to say something, though, which I think was interesting when that gentleman mentioned the Daily Mail, because that kind of was traditionally what used to happen all the time. It's the Daily Mail that's been answered. But I equally don't feel comfortable when people go on about the New Statesman. One of the best articles I read in relation to the war was actually by Munira Mirza, who works with Pamela Dow, which was in the New Statesman. And we can't complain about groupthink and echo chambers and then say that publication is this because it wrote something. There's loads in the New Statesman, by the way, which I think is tosh, right? There's loads in the Daily Mail that I think is tosh. I'm left-leaning and get called far-right because I voted Brexit. Those labels don't work for me anymore. I consider myself to be on the left because I'm old and I hate it when people call me a Tory, right? Because I'm not a Tory and I'm not on the right, right? It's my legacy. I'm on the left, revolutionary left even more, right? Deal with it. But it's also just because I'm old that we need the labels, and we don't need the labels. Read the bloody articles and say whether you agree with them or not, whichever publication they are in my view. Right. Person on the balcony, then there's somebody there. There's, all right, you two, and then you. Right, go on.
First of all, thank you very much for the debate. We are actually from MCC Hungary, and I think it's particularly interesting to hear about this idea of cultural framework and how this new elite has adopted this idea and there's this new influence. What I think is particularly important, hasn't really been talked about, is how social media, particularly for the younger generation, creates these echo chambers. And I think what's particularly prominent is not the idea that people are not willing to talk about the economy, not that they aren't willing to read longer articles, but the fact that this appeals to identity. And I think particularly in globalization, what's important is that it's much easier to appeal to a sense of identity and a sense of culture rather than it is to appeal to talks about the economy. And I think I wouldn't necessarily call this incompetence, but I think when we have this idea, it's much easier to neglect proper policy and mechanisms, which we would otherwise see, when we do have this sense of rather easier appeal or identity, which then tends to ignore the actual mechanisms that are required to generate an appropriate and an appropriate framework.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to be so rude. Right, those two, you two, who've had your hands up for ages, stand up. And the person next to you then, yeah, because I saw you.
Thank you, great. Just a question on the universities. I think just starting off with the point that Anand made about there being the Venn diagrams, it's definitely true there are different buckets of elites, but I think it's more like a flowchart, starting with one central place you can get into all of those different publications or the museums or have you, the top universities. And then in terms of it being captured by people on the far left, culturally, we've heard a lot about that. I won't say much more. But I would say, what is the safeguard? We can appoint certain people to go into certain positions, whether that's in the civil service or in universities, what have you. But there are no values to these places other than tolerating other people's opinions. Then the loudest voices and the most militant voices win. So there are incentives that need to be there for everybody in those institutions. But then what are the values that can be actively driven other than just free speech?
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Would the panel please comment on the practicality and merits, or not, of introducing a reopen nomination candidate on all our public elections?
Thank you.
Spoilt ballot papers, voting, a protest vote for a different party has no difference.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask young Harry where his time machine is parked, because I'd like to know how he got here from 1946. Mm-hmm. You talk as if redistribution was everything. We went through the recent COVID pandemic, and one of the economic consequences of it was a lot of people in their 50s reviewed their lives and didn't go back to work afterwards. And the government seems very puzzled as to why they didn't. Well, I went through a life-changing event in my mid-50s. My wife was dying and I had to give up my job to look after her. And when that was over and I looked at myself and what I needed to do for the rest of my life, I worked out if I went back to work, 3/4 of everything I generated was going to be taken from me for redistribution to be given to people I loathe, for purposes of which I entirely disapprove. And I decided I didn't need to work anymore and I stopped. And I've stopped because if I carried on amassing the wealth, 40% of it was going to be taken away anyway when I died. I couldn't give it to my kids. You've got a problem that people aren't economically active, and you've got all these problems because people like you, with your idiot ideas from the 1940s, have succeeded so much in creating these problems.
Very good. I can see that my appeal for civil debate at the start of the day didn't work well. Right. I was with you until you said people I loathe, and I was thinking, oh my God, I've been on the dole a few times. Do you know what I mean? Right, that gentleman there is the last person we're taking. I'm sorry, but we've got a whole festival. That's life.
Thank you. A quick one. This word elite, is it pejorative? It's starting to sound that way. Because it sounds like you do want an elite, but just not the ones or the ones you've got. So what do you want instead? And who, frankly, is going to want to be in it after what people like Matthew have done to the current one? You know, who wants to be part of this elite?
Okay, right.
And is it desirable?
Thank you. No, basically, you've got one sentence each in the order in which you spoke. Oh, God, which was... Oh, no, the reverse order. I'm doing it wrong. Right, Frank, what's your final sentence you want to say to the audience, please?
Well, the final sentence is that we need a new party, because if you want to create spaces where real discussion and debate can take place, we have to create that ourselves. It's not going to be a gift from any of the existing institutions, so we have to mobilize, organize, and create the condition where new ideas can emerge uninhibited. And we have no problem with an elite, as you were saying. The problem is that the elites at the moment are a bunch of schmucks. They really are. And they aren't really, they're not real elites in the sense of being better than the rest of society. They just seem to be in a position, not because of any of their merit or any of that sort. So we have to not be against elite, as you were saying earlier on, but we have to be against the pronoun elite, you know, who are so busy telling us what, asking us what our pronoun is, that they don't understand, they don't look you in the face and actually know that you don't need to ask me what my pronoun is. It's biologically self-evident.
Okay, thank you very much. That was a long sentence.
Very long.
Harry.
We're going in reverse order. Okay, got it.
Yeah,
well, look, it's been great to be here. It's great to know that I've won over certain members of the crowd. I actually want taxes on working people to go down. I want them to go up on wealth. So if you want to understand more about that, read The Great Tax Con, which you can find on Google, which is my piece explaining all this. I still haven't heard, and I'd love to hear Matt answer at the end whether he agrees with the economic ideas I've outlined, given that I've said that I actually agree with a lot of the problems we've identified with the cultural left. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Anand, that was a good sentence. Thanks.
Yeah, just to be very brief, it's very, very good to have these debates, and I hope we can have more of them. Just on the point the gentleman at the front made, we at least need to be honest about what we can expect if we want taxes to remain where they are or go down. We have low growth, we have massive debt repayments. Taxes are going to have to go up to keep public services where they are now. If the NHS is going to keep up with rising demand, that's 3% more in its budget every year. We face very, very difficult choices, and simply wishing them away, as many of our politicians and indeed commentators do, is not the way we're going to start to address them.
Thank you very much indeed. Pamela.
I don't think I am in favour of a reopen nominations category, partly because whenever I sit here grumbling about everyone else being incompetent, I've got sort of Teddy Roosevelt's voice saying, well, just get in the blooming arena yourself if you want to make a difference. So I don't think reopening nominations would help us get the sort of better politicians, better leaders that we need. I think Civic Future will do something, but you know, bear with us. It's a big old job. And I think I made my opinion clear about elite. I think we want to look up to people who are brilliant, but let's just make sure they are brilliant in whatever fields they've chosen to go into.
Okay, thank you very much, Pamela. Matt.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons the book resonated among so many people is because we all want the same thing. We want a politics, to go back to the question over here, that's representative of all values in society, and that's clearly not taking place. We can see that on a wide array of issues. We want institutions which give sufficient voice to everybody in society, not just a university-educated minority elite. And we want our prevailing culture, our national conversation, to push back hard against this utterly divisive identity politics, which is now teaching our children that the only interesting or significant thing about them is not their character, but their sexual identity or the color of their skin. Nobody wants this. Nobody wants
that's
to see this
like
invading our culture. So I think it's pretty obvious what we want, and it's entirely plausible to do all of those things, as Frank says. We need to build a new and a very different politics.
Okay, thank you very much. I gave the panel impossible job, and I think they did really bloody well, to be fair. I, however, have overrun time-wise, and my colleagues are going to kill me. I wanted to just say one thing. This is the start of the festival. We've got sessions, actually, this lunchtime on tax. We've got sessions on universities. We've got all sorts of things that people have asked questions. They're in the programme. And you won't be able to go to everything, because as we sit in this crowded room, there's 10 other crowded rooms in this festival as we speak, just as animated, saying they haven't got time. So take advantage of it. But somebody asked about public spaces and building them, politics in pubs, the salon sessions, the salons that are springing up all around the place. There is a grassroots movement, but to be honest with you, don't ask the panel what to do. Do it yourselves. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the day.